Members, I call the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. And Representative Gilman, looks like you're thumbing through the minutes. Would you be able to move the minutes from March 27th when you've had a little chance to look?
So moved, Chair.
Representative Gilman moves the minutes from March 27th. Members, are there any questions or issues with the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are carried from March 27th. Representative Nash, if you'd like to make your way to the desk. Since Chair Nash is not a member of the committee, I will move that House File 2824 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Chair Nash, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So first, I want to thank my bipartisan co-authors. This is a true bipartisan effort. There are two Democrats, two Republicans on the bill. And if you spend any time on Minnesota lakes, like I do, smallmouth bass caught on Mille Lacs, you'll recognize that bass fishing, or fishing in general, is one of the great legacies that we have in the state of Minnesota. And this bill would simply remove the seasons that we have on bass. Now, I will admit, when I was first asked to carry this bill, I wanted to understand the biology behind all this. And I have testifiers here who can attest to the fact that, from a biology perspective, that the bass have plenty of time to nest and breed, and that there actually has been historic upticks in bass population in the netting that has gone on. But the practical value of this is, if you've ever been associated with some of the youth tournaments that you see in high school as a sport, this is actually going to increase their ability to have fishing days on the lake. Because when you have a season, you can't target a species. And if you can't target a species, you can't have a tournament that's focused on that particular species. So this time of year, you could have a crappie tournament, and that's not all that exciting, but a bass tournament would be. So the value of this will be secondary for our resorts and just for general commerce. If you understand that the resort region has suffered in years past, having the ability to go and angle for bass without a limitation of a season would be very helpful and beneficial for them. So it is a very simple bill and a very bipartisan bill. And if you've never spent a day on the water, I will tell you that there is nothing that cannot be solved by going out and dropping a line and doing a little bit of fishing. So, Mr. Chair, I have some testifiers, if you would be so kind.
Looks like we have Mr. Holston up first. If you would introduce yourself for the record, you know the drill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Mark Holston. I'm the executive director for the MinFish Sport Fishing Foundation and Coalition. We are a nonprofit organization that works and advocates for anglers throughout the state of Minnesota. Where our primary concern is, or issues are, wanting to improve fishing in Minnesota through proper management and quality management. We see this as a small step in providing the opportunity for anglers throughout Minnesota to be able to go out and enjoy the sport that they love. As this committee, I know, is aware, when you add the number of licensed anglers throughout the state of Minnesota and then incorporate the unlicensed, which are your kids under the age of 15, 16, you're in that 30% of Minnesota population is an angler. And we see this as a small step to open that opportunity for them to be able to go out and enjoy the sport that they so passionately enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I think I have Jim Bell. Thank you, Jim. If you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
I will. Thank you. First off, thank you to everybody for representing the state of Minnesota. We truly appreciate it. My name is Jim. Jimmy is what I go by, Bell. I am president of the Student Angler Organization in the state of Minnesota. We are a nonprofit that was started really to give youth anglers more opportunities across the state, but also, just as importantly, to get their parents out and going as well. As Mark stated, we've had great support for this whole effort across all avenues. The student anglers and the anglers of Minnesota certainly are supportive of this. We have pushed upon it for years, and we're happy to see it coming to fruition. We know that the Minnesota DNR and its leadership is fully supportive of this. We also know that MinFish, as he mentioned, the advocacy group for the state of Minnesota fishermen, is fully supportive. The Mille Lacs Band and the Leech Lake Band are fully supportive of it. And certainly the data and the science shows that the impact is not there. So one way to look at that is truly to look at a survey that was done or analysis did for the DNR just recently. It took 53 years worth of data. So that's really netting and things like that to really count the amount of bass that are in the state. Over those 53 years, on average, largemouth bass per year has increased by count by 4.5%, smallmouth bass 3.4%. So every year we've seen an increase, which is pretty amazing. The one tie-in that I really want to bring in is the student angling side of it, as people have said. We've seen a huge increase in student angling in the state of Minnesota, which is just absolutely awesome. The more we can get people outside, and I think part of it is due to the new cool thing in schools is the outdoors. And keeping people in the outdoors really is a great way to introduce ethics and things that I think are very important. So we've seen that increase for 5 to 10 years, and probably not any more than we saw over COVID. As you all realized, we had a huge increase of sporting activities outside during the COVID period, which is pretty awesome. But now that we've got them started, we've got to keep them engaged. And the way that you keep them engaged is giving them more opportunity. And a bill like this is just going to do exactly that for them. One of the greatest outcomes of the student angling part of it is really not just engaging the youth, but the youth coming back from events. Maybe they went and fished with Billy next door. They come back home, they talk to mom and dad and say, hey, we would really love to have you, mom and dad, get involved as well. So we're re-engaging a lot of those. Again, I think the opportunity is really to take these young anglers, keep them engaged. As all of us know, much of the DNR budget comes from license sales, and all of these kids are starting to buy licenses, and the more that we can keep them engaged, the better off we're going to be. I thank all of you. I ask for your support. I agree it's bipartisan and should be a great thing, but thank you very kindly.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Mr. Persons, DNR Fisheries Section Manager, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad Parsons, Fisheries Section Manager for the Minnesota DNR. I can keep this brief and talk that the biological statistics that, that Jimmy provided, we support those. We have been following our bass populations for many years in this state. Currently, bass actually are spawning more into May and June as opposed to March and April when this proposed fishing season would occur. And so there are really no concerns about interfering with bass. Bass are doing quite well in this state and throughout the upper Midwest. And we see this as an opportunity to provide more angling experience for people with no biological risk, particularly given the fact that in the spring, the water is cold, fish are fairly shallow, hooking mortality with catch and release would be extremely low, and we see no biological reason. We have looked very closely and worked very closely about the biology of this, and we feel comfortable that this is something that can be provided to the anglers with no conservation risk.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Anybody in the audience today that would like to testify to the bill? Seeing none, members, questions? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill author, so what would the season be if I am going to get a license? Is it on the calendar year? Maybe this is a DNR question. Thank you.
Chair Nash, or your testifier?
Mr. Chair, I'll let the testifier handle that.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, our license season is from begins March 1st and runs through the end of the following February. So with this, it would really all it would change would be allowing angling from the close in February until the current opener, which is in the second Saturday of May.
While we wait for other members that might have questions, I was curious. You did talk a little bit already about the increase in populations, and I think you said, or somebody did, and every year we've seen an increase. Maybe Mr. Bell said that, but Mr. Parsons, you could address this very easily, I'm assuming. Is there any factors that we're specifically attributing to the increase in populations? It could be just good management, could be fishing itself. People are releasing more frequently. What do we know?
Yeah, one of the things we do know is that bass are harvested very rarely by people, and that has been very continuous and expanding over the years. We also have system change in our lakes in terms of clear water, which favors species such as bass, and longer growing seasons, which also favor warm water or cool water species such as bass. So it's a combination of many things. We do maintain in certain places special regulations for bass. Those are meant more for quality and larger fish as opposed to the numbers of fish.
Appreciate that answer. I would just say anecdotally, as a bow fisherman over the last decade, I felt like there was more and more bass that we would see while we're out in the night, in the dark of night, Representative Hansen, targeting some of those species that are legal for harvest bow fishing. And it's incredible how many bass are there as we're looking for carp, common carp, and other species. Mm-hmm. And just, I guess I'm not surprised to hear today that there's been a statistical increase that has shown up as well, but interesting information. Members, any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering from DNR perspective, if this is something we should have like a 5 or 10 year sunset on, just to revisit it, just in case, there is an impact on the population.
Mr. Parsons.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, what this would do is allow us to modify our rules to change the season, and I would fully expect our department, we will continue doing our bass surveys over the course of the years and keeping an eye on our populations. At this point, I would suspect that the department can handle that through our rulemaking process.
Any other questions, members? All right, seeing none, Chair Nash, if you'd like to close us out.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Once again, thank you to the bipartisan authorship on this. Bass fishing is a tremendous outdoor activity, and yes, the outdoors is cool. And, I spend, I think, about 100 days a year fishing, and when I'm on my boat, I call it sales calls so that I can tell people, sorry, I can't take your meeting, I'm out on sales calls. But if you go to somewhere like Mille Lacs and you just look anecdotally through the water, you will see far more smallmouth than you've ever seen before in the many years I've been going up there. It is a tremendous fishery, and what this bill would do would allow more people to really be able to experience the fish of a lifetime, because a smallmouth on an ultralight is probably about the best type of fishing you're ever going to do, because it's an incredible ride. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you so much.
Thank you for presenting your bill. With that, additionally, the bill is laid over. Members, next up, House File 623. Swazinski, if you would make your way and present your bill. I will move that House File 623 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill, as you're not a member of the committee, Chair Swazinski. And I think you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Chair Heintzman. I have the DE1 amendment that would get the bill in the shape that I prefer the bill to be in.
All right. I would move that 623 DE1, the author's amendment, be, author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. Any questions on the amendment, members? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair Swazinski, to your bill, as amended.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the Environment Committee. It's an honor to be in front of you to present House File 623. House File 623 is a simple repeal of law that eliminates the shotgun zone in the state of Minnesota when it comes to deer hunting. Currently, the state is really a world of two worlds, kind of north generally of I-94. Deer hunters across the state enjoy the use of a rifle. And south of 94 approximately, the use of shotgun and pistol is generally used for the taking of deer. As technology has changed, aspects of hunting has changed quite dramatically. Just visiting with some sports shops just in the last day or two and asking kind of where are your sales when it comes to the technology that is out there, and a vast majority, almost 60 to 70 to 80%, depending on which shop you're talking, a vast majority of procurement of guns being used for taking of deer is a pistol calibered or rifle calibered pistol. And so whether that be a bolt action, a semi-automatic, or whatnot, a lot of folks are making that choice. And this is a simplification of technology that's already been out there. A lot of folks are already using the particular calibers that would be impacted. This bill simply talks about the length of the barrel. We've got the amendment that we just passed. I appreciate that. The D1 amendment primarily changes. There was two counties that were particularly concerned about this. This gets them a carve-out, essentially, but it does ask them to just make movement as they learn about how it's impacting counties around them. If they choose to continue the carve-out that the shotgun only in the Olmsted and Dodge County, they continue to do that. If they decide not to, then they would simply be absorbed as the rest of the state. That's what the bill does. You know, it's also to encourage, you know, if you talk to a lot of the young hunters, in my family particularly, my wife too would say that she prefers to hunt with a rifle caliber pistol because of the kick. And compared to a 20-gauge or a 12-gauge shotgun, that is a much more manageable thing. And so to encourage youth, encourage young people, and encourage women to hunt, at least in my family, that's what I've heard, and that's what the bill does. And I certainly appreciate some good conversation and your support. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation on the bill, Chair Swazinski. I see we have Eric Simonson to testify. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. My name is Eric Simonson. I represent the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. We are an association of more than 11,000 members spread out all across Minnesota. We want to express our gratitude to Representative Swazinski for authoring House File 623 and express our full support of the bill as we have done several years in the past. Although we do like the unamended version a little bit better, but we'll get into that, I think. House File 623 basically eliminates what is known as a shotgun-only zone, which encompasses a good portion of the southern part of our state, as was already explained. But I want to tell you why we are supporting this change. This provision was originally put into law to minimize the impact on the wild herd. At the time, shotguns were far less accurate than rifles and were limited to much shorter ranges. Today, the deer herd in this portion of the state only continues to grow. Today's shotguns can be every bit as accurate as a rifle, and any belief that they are not is simply not true. This change would allow hunters to use a rifle to take deer anywhere in the state, but for the amendment, anywhere in the state where hunting by firearm is allowed. Rifles often provide much less of a recoil than a shotgun, making it the preferred weapon of choice for youth hunters and others who may not appreciate the recoil impact of a typical shotgun. Simply said, this change would encourage more Minnesotans to take to the field to hunt deer. Members, deer hunting in Minnesota is more than a family-oriented, time-honored tradition. It is a $500 million-plus industry, as significant to Minnesota's economy as many other important pastimes. This is a change that makes sense, and it is time to pass this bill. Lastly, let me address the question that seems to always come up. What about those counties or cities that may not want to allow the use of rifles in their area? We believe Current law allows a local unit of government through the ordinance process to restrict the use of firearms in their own jurisdiction. This is how it is handled all across the northern part of the state now. Take, for example, the city of Duluth, which is located in St. Louis County. St. Louis County is a large county, across most of which you can hunt deer with a rifle. But I can't go to downtown city of Duluth and hunt deer with a rifle or with a shotgun for that matter. Why? Because the city of Duluth has taken advantage of the current law and state statute, which allows cities, counties, townships to control the discharge of weapons within their own jurisdiction. If Olmsted County or Dodge County wanted to opt out of the current law, if this law were to pass, they could do that by a vote of their county board and take up the ordinance process. We strongly believe that that's the way that that should be handled. However, we also would support Senator or Representative Swazinski's bill the way it's amended as well. We think this change makes good sense for Minnesota. We appreciate the committee's consideration of the bill, and I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Pat Rivers. Laura, Assistant Commissioner. Even better.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, Assistant Commissioner. Speaking here for Pat Rivers today, had another conflict. We all know we've been talking about the shotgun zone for several years now. I appreciate Representative Szczynski bringing the bill back again. It's really not a matter of safety. The shotgun zone was first created because it was much like fishing in a barrel, so to speak, shooting deer with a rifle in some of the flat zones, so that they thought they'd go to a shotgun. The safety is not an issue. In fact, what we'd see is rifles are allowed in these areas of the state year-round, even at night, to take coyote and fox. And the safety really relies on the user. As everybody knows, the first rule of firearm safety is knowing what's your target and beyond, keeping your finger off the trigger until you're ready to shoot and being responsible for where that cartridge is going. So we feel that this is time for a discussion. Other states have done it, and we look forward to work with the legislature on this issue.
Thank you. And is there anyone else in the audience today that would like to testify on the bill? Seeing no hands, I will move to member questions. Members, any questions? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman, and Representative, for your bill. I just have a question about the exemption language. It appears to me from this that only Dodge and Olmsted counties are eligible to have an exemption. Is that correct?
Representative Szczynski.
Chair, Representative Finke, that is correct, yes.
So,
Representative Finke.
Thank you. It seems strange to me, I guess, to say that other counties may wish to next year be exempted from this and not be eligible. Am I reading that right? Like if another county decided this wasn't going the way they wanted it to, but they're not eligible counties, they could not exempt themselves.
I would just remind members that we did hear in testimony that there are examples of counties that have placed restrictions on these kinds of firearms-related issues. Representative Swazinski.
Chair Heinzman, Representative Finke, we believe that, yes, kind of as Chair Heinzman spoke, all counties have the ability to create an ordinance and exempt themselves if this was to move forward. So any county in northern Minnesota could currently pass an ordinance like this. But just from a conversations with county boards, these two particular counties had reached out, and so and it at the end of the day, it becomes an issue of enforcement. So if it's a state enforcement, so as we write counties into law, then it becomes a state responsibility, right? So the DNR officers are out passing and enforcing state law. If it's a county ordinance, then the counties would be the ones to enforce that. And so that's the big separation, and that's why we're really trying to be limited on the counties that we include in that, because of one, we've only heard from a few county boards that were interested in potentially having that carve out, but then also understanding the fact that we have limited resources from a DNR standpoint when it comes to this. You know, DNR obviously spoke on behalf of the bill, and if we have it in state statute that those counties are exempted, then the state would be responsible for that complexity of enforcement. So as you're out in the field, you know, whether this this field or this group of trees is in one county and this group of trees is, our concern is that if we have too intensive of a patchwork, we not only increase the intensity to complicate the ability to enforce, but then who has to do the enforcement? So whether it's the county, county deputies, county sheriffs, or state DNR officers. And so that's why we have two counties. I'd have preferred that we didn't, but just, you know, through the legislative process, trying to find, as we like to say, peace in the valley. That's why the amendment was drafted the way it was. And that's why. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Finke.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. And then to your point, we heard testimony about a city not being allowing hunting in downtown Duluth. I'm sure there are other reasons that you can't shoot deer in downtown Duluth other than the exemption rule from the shotgun ordinance. At least I would hope so. So I just want to make sure. I don't actually have an opinion. I'm neutral on whether or not we have a shotgun zone. I just want to make sure that, like, sure, it makes sense that we are doing it in a way that is fair. So I appreciate your response. That makes sense to me. And thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I see on the second page of the amendment, line 2.1, it talks about honor before March 31st, which of course was yesterday. So I'm wondering if this were to pass, when does this take become law, and therefore when is the first time the March 31st deadline would need to be observed?
Chair Swazinski or your testifier.
Well, I believe as the amendment's written, it would, so even if the bill took place, so they wouldn't have passed an ordinance, it would be under consideration. So once the bill actually becomes law, so this is just a bill, so it would be the next March. So if it, let's say the bill is on the governor's desk between now and when we're sine die at the end of session, with all our budget bills passed and agreed to, then it would occur that next March.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you. So to clarify, this bill, if it is engrossed and becomes law, would not impact the deer hunting season of 2025, correct?
Chair Swazinski or Assistant Commissioner?
Chair Heintzman, I don't believe it would. I'd be happy that we could maybe potentially do that, but the issue is also timing. So March 31st is an important date because, you know, a lot of the hunting regulations, the books that get printed, so it's just a really timing thing so that, you know, the agency, the department, and the rest, so we're all on the same page because there is going to be a little bit of a process to this, and so we're just trying to be as forthright but also respectful of time as possible. So
I think maybe Ms. Taylor could talk about this for a second if there's any questions that remain.
Mr. Chair and members, as drafted, there is not an effective date, so it would probably become law July 1st or August 1st, depending on whether it was in a budget bill. But I guess I would defer to the DNR whether or not through rules they could carry on as they would. Otherwise, it would be eliminating the shotgun use zone except for eligible counties for this season, unless they could somehow through rules.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, Ms. Taylor, it's something we may need to work on. I think the language is clear the way it's written that it wouldn't impact March 31st of the year the season is to occur. Obviously, the bill will pass this summer if it were to go. But we may want to look at an overall effective date as well. So the concept works. It's just when would it go into law? For example, if this were to pass, our regulations books would not contain that right now. So we would want to work with you to make sure it's not effective until the following deer season. So it would be 2026 yeah. Deer season.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Purcell took care of my question. I think I just reiterate that we might want to get some clarification as to when this bill goes into effect. Representative Finke, I'm neutral on this. So just wanted to make sure that we tighten it up, make sure that everybody is on the same page, and then I think we can go forward. Thank you.
Representative Falconer.
Thank you, Chair. I guess my question, and thank you for bringing this bill forward, would this... If this were to take effect, perhaps this question is for the DNR system commissioner, how would it affect current hunting zones? Like, are they going to have to be redrawn for any safety concerns? And I guess where I'm primarily coming from is I grew up in Red Wing. just outside of Red Wing, and our family hunting property was one of these, you know, farm fields, bluff areas, but was, you know, in that kind of middle zone directly adjacent to residential. And whereas right now you could hunt with a shotgun across a farm field 400 yards away, no really concern for the houses, but then of course introduce the rifle into that situation, that then becomes, you know, potential for a dangerous situation. So in that case and others across the state, particularly in the southeast where we've got this much more intersection of residential right up to farming and hunting zones, is the DNR going to have to take a look at redrawing hunting zone maps out of safety concerns?
Sure.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, it's a great question. Our deer permit areas are what we call those actual zones or areas. They're based more on population and roads and things like that, so I do not see a need to do this, but we do have the authority to adjust those by rule whenever needed. I don't see the use of a shotgun or a rifle changing that at all, just as we've seen. We haven't changed it due to CWD or anything like that either. So the zones are pretty well known by people, the roads, the boundaries, and things like that, and they rarely move, so I don't think that would be a concern.
Representative Nelson.
Just one follow-up.
I'm sorry, just hang on. Excuse me.
Thank you, Chair.
Falconer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I've just, you know, from my 30 years of hunting outside of Red Wing, we've noticed as housing has encroached that the zones have shrunk. And so we're hunting zone 341, but the actual ability to hunt in specific locations within there shrink more and more due to safety concerns. Build up a neighborhood on a farm field, of course you're not going to hunt there anymore, nor should you. And so it's just one of those things that I'm just concerned. My area where I grew up hunting, where I would like my kids to, my friends and family that still live down there, could see an erosion of their hunting lands.
I'm not hearing a question, so Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman, and I think this might be for the Assistant Commissioner. Is there any data showing firearm safety accidents in the shotgun zone on either side of it? Are there any more accidents on one side than the other?
Mr. Chair, firearm zone
versus shotgun zone.
Assistant Commissioner.
Assistant Enforcement Director Robert Grecki, address that.
If you would introduce yourself for the record, and if you have an answer for that question, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Grecki, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. To your question, no. We have not seen statistically any difference between firearms types, whether it's shotgun or rifle. As a matter of fact, over the last 3 years in 2022, we only had one firearms deer hunting related accident. That was with a rifle. In 2023, there was three. Two shotgun, one rifle, and then in 2024 it was five, three rifle and two shotgun. Most of those, mind you, were self-inflicted accidents, getting in and out of deer stands, nothing to do with range and knowing where you're at, but certainly is a concern for all firearm types.
Representative Nelson.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Heinzman. Thank you for the answer to it. Good to know that it's, not that self-inflicted is any better, but at least it's, you know, it's not a, I don't think it's really bringing up a, you know, safety concern in that way. And I think one of the things, you know, we, need to be reminded of, you know, on the Agriculture Committee, we talk a lot about the deer depredation on our crops and things like that, especially in the southeast part of the state. There's potentially a CWD issue in that area. And, you know, when the shotgun zone was adopted, you know, it's been stated several times, you know, this was to limit effectiveness. And, you know, I think it has eliminated effectiveness. And, you know, we've got a population issue in white-tailed deer because of this now. And I think it's, looking at the safety side of things, I think that while, yes, we do need to be concerned about it, I don't see that is an actual concern of really why we should not allow this. I think it really comes down to the population, and if we see the deer numbers continuing to increase, and especially in southeast Minnesota, I think that there's we need to up our game in essence of allowing harvest happen. So thank you for bringing this bill.
Representative Swazinski, looks like we've come to the end of member questions. Do you? Guess we have not. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the motion for this bill, Mr. Chair?
That it would be laid over as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've just noticed around the table that I've heard a lot of strong neutrals on this bill, so I haven't heard anybody opposed to this at this point. And I'll just say, as someone who represents a district that is split between rifle zone and shotgun zone, and for me, I'm living the inequity that is this current policy. I live in the shotgun zone while my neighbors can shoot with rifles. And it's time that we bring about more equality. So thank you, Representative Swazinski, for taking a strong step in the direction to move us towards equality. This is an area of passion. This is an area where the folks across my district and in the vast parts of the state very much want to see this changed, and to move us in this direction is a very positive step. So thank you for working together with stakeholders to do that, and I look forward to seeing this bill through the process and without opposition, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking, you know, that we should consider moving this right to the floor.
Just looking around the table at the suggestion. There you have it, members, with no one opposed necessarily. It doesn't appear that we have the option to do that. Representative Hansen.
I would oppose.
Chair Swazinski, final comments.
Thank you again for the robust conversation. I would encourage, if you do have questions for me, DNR, the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, ask it. You know, I think this is, you know, this is a, it's a meaningful conversation when it comes to the role of this. When I think of Minnesota Outdoors, we heard that with Representative Nash's bill when it comes to fishing. There's not too many folks that don't have that same conversation and have a thought or a memory about bringing deer home and making sausage and doing the rest. And what we can do when it comes to thoughtfully thinking about the management of our deer herd, thoughtfully about encouraging youth and others to get into the sport, I think this bill does make a step in it. And making some caveats for folks that are very concerned, but also I just appreciate the conversation, appreciate your support, and certainly if you do sit on the conference committee or if you change of hearts and we want to move this separately, I'm always open for that. So thanks again.
Chair Swazinski, thank you for presenting your bill. With that, the bill as amended is laid over. Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz, would you like to lay your bill over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Schultz, it looks like you have an amendment to get the bill in the shape that you would like. Would you like to explain your amendment and make the motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move adoption of the DE1 amendment to House File 647, which encompasses changes to the bill and changes to state policy that are a totality of an ongoing conversation and specifically additional guidance that has been provided to me by the DNR to write this policy for the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions to the amendment? Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. I noticed that the one of the big changes here is that it allows use of the Hinckley Aquifer in the metropolitan area where it did not before. I have some concerns on that. If this is a recommendation from the DNR, I'd like to hear a little bit more from the DNR about what their thought is and why they're looking at for the first priority use.
Representative, if you'd like the DNR to come forward and maybe add a little info on the amendment. Otherwise, if you have it covered, go right ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair and Chair Fisher, I would just say, you know, this we're seeking to adopt this amendment to get the bill in the form that I'd like it, which is at this is at the direction of the DNR, and I would welcome their additional sentiments, but I know that they all are also seeking to testify on the bill, so I wonder if we should just adopt this as it is and then get that testimony.
Sure.
Let's go ahead and do that. Members, the motion is that we would add the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Representative Schultz, your bill is in the shape that you would like. Go ahead and let's get going with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Fisher. Thank you to the members of the committee for hearing House File 647. This is a bill to address some concerns that have come to the surface on the Mount Simon Aquifer. Representative Jordan, you didn't like that? I love it. This is an opportunity, members, to address an issue and, frankly, an unintended consequence that has resulted from the most recent change or the 2021 change to this policy, which is to address the communities across the state where they don't have access to any other aquifer in their area and to address the needs that they have if there's a well that they need to drill, that they have that ability to work through the normal regulatory process with the DNR and for the DNR to use this very narrow scope where there is no other water to provide access to water for those communities and for the citizens of the state. We know that this is the oldest and deepest aquifer, but there are still places, specifically on the edges of my district, where there isn't another aquifer for residents to access. And so that's what this bill seeks to address and to provide the certainty that there is a process for the DNR with a very narrow scope to see this through so that people can have access to water. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
First up to testify, Minnesota Christmas Tree Association. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Ben Wolson, and I'm here representing our family Christmas tree farm that's been in business for over 50 years in Isani County. We are currently the largest Christmas tree farm in Minnesota, and we provide Christmas trees to 30,000 families each year as a center for their Christmas celebration. We take that responsibility very seriously. I'm also here representing the Minnesota Christmas Tree Association and our 70 member farms as the current president of the MNCTA. Our crop is the original green product. We were green before it was cool. Trees are planted just like row crops each spring with the intention of selling them to eventually turn a profit. The biggest difference for us is that it takes 7 to 10 years before we eventually harvest that product. But as these trees are growing, they provide many environmental benefits. They help eliminate soil erosion, provide windbreaks, produce oxygen, provide wildlife habitat, and provide a natural beauty. Real trees are completely biodegradable and can be recycled and reused for mulch. On the flip side, fake trees go to a landfill after Christmas where they will harm the environment with dangerous chemicals for hundreds of years. So back in 2021, there was a law passed restricting drilling new wells into this Mount Simon aquifer. The way the law currently reads, we can only drill a new well for homes for drinking water and not at all for irrigating. Because our entire farm sits above this aquifer, it has been an extremely difficult few years for us to get water. The DNR did give us a one-year permit to pump water out of a pond, but that is not a good long-term solution and not something they want to continue doing. We've also been running a water truck continually through the summer months, but this becomes extremely costly and labor intensive. Even with these limited options, we are not able to get all of the 80,000 fir trees that we plant each year watered adequately. Our planting stock costs us about $150,000 annually, and without water, this is money thrown away. Unlike row crops, our trees only need to be irrigated the first year that they are planted. And once they're established, they're good to go. And many of our species that we plant don't need much water at all. So we're really only irrigating about a tenth of our acreage each year. Therefore, we come nowhere near the amount of water that's permitted on our old wells. We've tried to do things the right way over the last few years. We paid $2,000 a piece to dig 6 test wells to see if we could draw water above the aquifer, only to find out that only one of them was viable. We also paid $20,000 to put in a well, only to find out that it didn't produce any water. This was $32,000 we spent just in hopes of finding water, and this is not something that is sustainable for most family Christmas tree farms in our state. We are asking that you support this bill for tree farmers just like us that are wanting to continue in the greenest industry on earth. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I believe, Mr. Lurie. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman, Co-Chair Fisher, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Lurie, Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. And on behalf of our organization, I'm glad to share our support for Rep. Schultz, HF 647. I'm new to this issue, I'll admit, so I'll keep my comments brief and work to build on what Ben shared. I'm proud that the Wolsons are Farmers Union members and glad to support them in this effort. And in reviewing this with some of our local leaders and our team, I think we appreciated that this change really is narrowly tailored. Just to reemphasize, it's only for those who have no other option for potable water. It requires best available water conservation technologies and practices. And finally, it's left up to the discretion of the DNR commissioner. And I really appreciate not just Rep. Schultz's work on this, but also the DNR's work on this proposal, their conversations with us. I also understand from speaking with regional staff that there may be a couple of other folks in our membership who this would affect, but really my understanding is it's very targeted regionally for who this is gonna affect. I know water issues broadly can be contentious. That's why there's been so much work on this bill. I'll also just say from reaching out to our local leaders, I didn't surface any concerns about this proposal, just support for making this fix. So thanks for the opportunity to share some thoughts, support for this bill, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Next, I think we have Randall. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Heisman, Chair Fisher. Randall Donine with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'm a section manager within the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. The Mount Simon Aquifer is a very valuable natural resource to Minnesotans. It's a very deep, old aquifer that recharges very slowly. Previous legislatures had recognized the importance of that and limited the use of that aquifer within the 7-county metro area. In 2021, those protections were extended throughout the full extent of the aquifer within the state, and there was an unintended consequence of that. The aquifer itself at the edges of the aquifer is the only viable aquifer source for a water supply. And so there is a geographic limitation to it on the edge of the aquifer. And this bill tries to address that exact limitation if there is somebody that is the only source they have there. And the changes that we've been working with the author on the change from potable water to domestic is really to align this statute with other important statutes that we have about the priority water uses. The priority water uses, we have 6 priority water uses, and the number one is domestic use. And domestic use is defined in rule, and so aligning where the potable isn't. And so potable, even you can kind of think about the dictionary term for it, but the statute does have a domestic use in there, and we do have a definition of domestic use. And so then that is the highest priority use in the state. And so we don't actually see that this would open it up any greater than the potable language did. It will allow priority uses 1 through 5 to use this water if it is in this geographic area where this is the only viable aquifer you have. The one priority use it doesn't allow is 6, which is non-essential uses, and we don't want this valuable resource to be used on any non-essential uses. And I think that was the main points I wanted to make. Oh, yeah, just, the Minnesota does have a really good laws around water use and what the DNR needs to evaluate in water use. And those, this the sustainability standard in 103.287 is a great standard that we have to apply to any applications, and so we feel that it does a good job of protecting our resources.
Thank you very much. Anybody else in the audience today that wants to testify on the bill? Not seeing any hands. Members, anybody have comments? Representative Finley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, for your bill, I would just be curious to get the take. I looked up priority uses 1 through 5. I can't help but notice that one of them is power production. And I can't help but also notice we are debating whether or not to have data centers that require a large amount of water. So I just would like to know, does this bill allow the DNR to take water from the aquifer and bring it to those data centers to produce power?
Representative Schultz, or to your testifiers. DNR, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Most of those large water uses would fall in the priority 5 water use. So it would allow, if that was the only water source available and they met the standards, it would allow that usage.
Representative Finke.
Thank you for the answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Would it allow water to be used in mining in priority uses 1 through 5?
Mr. Chair, I can take that one.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Finke. So let's overlay where the Mount Simon aquifer is for a second. In our state currently, there is, to my knowledge, beyond sand and gravel, there is no mining project that would be within the constraints of our state and the Mount Simon aquifer. So hopefully that answers your question.
Representative Finke.
It does not, because it doesn't indicate in priority uses that that water can't be moved.
Representative Schultz, or to your testifier.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. We actually, interestingly enough, legislation was passed recently that limits the bulk transfer of water. And we limited it to 50 miles. Or this body and the governor limited it to 50 miles. So it would have some limitations on how far that water could move. We did, I believe, the statute does allow, if you're on part of a regional water system with a community of public water supply, it can be up to 100 miles apart, just because we have some areas in the state where they're sharing water across different communities. So there would be a limitation as to how far the water could be moved.
Mayor Finke.
Yes, thank you, Chair Heintzman. I appreciate the time. So just for the record, this bill would allow them to use, them being people who are requesting permits from the DNR, to use that water for potential data centers that may or may not be in front of the legislature this year, but we don't believe it would be eligible for helium mines or other mines. I just want to make sure I'm understanding, because this is these are very controversial pieces. I support the Christmas tree farmers.
Thank you.
I want to make sure we're not also supporting something we don't support. So thank you very much. I appreciate that. If you would go on the record there, that would be very useful.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. There is not, based upon my own research here, there is no mining project that I think would meet your ear that would fall within that 50-mile threshold that he just talked about. I just did a little bit of math to the one that I believe would be nearest, and that one is 67 miles away. So it would not meet that threshold.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. A couple of things I've got a question on is where I see the bulk of that Section B that was added in. First of all, if I could get for the public the definition of, it says an appropriation within a metropolitan county is defined as 473.121 subdivision 4.
Mr. Dureen?
I'm sorry, could you restate the question?
Yeah, if you could.
Chair Fisher.
The counties that are covered as definition of the metropolitan county.
Oh, it's the seven county area. I'm not going to remember them off the top of my head.
No, thank you. And so the reason I'm bringing that up is because it says the Mount Hinckley could be tapped as a first priority water use in that area. I'm a little bit concerned because we're in the Seven County area. This is where we have other aquifers that are available. And the concern that I have is I'm seeing as first priority use is domestic. But I know that most of the domestic water supplies also supply other businesses out there. So besides the first priority use, you've got other businesses that might be also receiving the water. So when you say first priority use, how do you reconcile those two issues in this type of situation?
Mr. Dineen.
Thank you, Chair. Chairs. The current way we try to address those issues, because it can be complicated with a public water supply system when you're delivering, but we do, as part of any community that serves over 1,000 individuals, is required to submit a public water supply plan. And as part of that water supply plan, they need to address the priority uses, and that would be how we would enforce how they're using that water. But it can be very challenging, I'll grant you that.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. And I'm asking for a couple of reasons. Number one is, given in the East Metro, we've got one aquifer that's heavily contaminated with PFAS out there. So that with this provision in here, would that say that in that area, instead of looking at surface water, they could instead apply to have pumping happening on long term out of the Mount Simon Hinckley aquifer?
Mr. Dineen.
Thank you, Chairs. Yes, we've actually looked at that, and that area of the Mount Simon, it really isn't as productive, and so actually wouldn't be able to supply the needs to those communities in that area. But conceptually, yes, the aquifer would be an alternate source in that area.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. And then the other question that I have is that when communities apply for the permits, as the domestic water supply, as we heard before, you know, if they're doing domestic water supply, they could also end up supplying a data center. I know that some of the communities in the metropolitan area are looking at data centers and are looking not necessarily off the surface, but it sounds like going to the domestic water supply. So in that kind of situation in the metropolitan area, could it be conceivable that could happen?
Mr. Dineen.
Thank you, Chairs. My understanding of the way we would have to implement this is that if we had a new request for a community to tap into the Mount Simon aquifer, they would need to demonstrate how they were going to limit that to the first priority use. And that would not include data centers.
Okay. Looks like we have a couple more. Representative Hansen. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question similarly to my backyard as co-chair Fisher. So I believe on the map that I was looking at that the southeast Minnesota, which is dealing with some nitrate issues in our different aquifers. So I'm wondering then if a community not in the Seven County metro area would be able to then tap into this for their drinking water as well, either private or municipally.
Mr. Dineen.
The way it's written is that it would need to be their only water source. And so if they did have another viable water source, they would not be able to.
I think we've come to the end of questions. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the members of the committee for your intentional and good questions about this. I think that those are relevant conversations to have. And if there's follow-up that's needed for us to continue to work this through in coordination with the DNR, that's my promise to you that we will work together on those things. Again, my hope with this bill is just to provide the opportunity for those who don't have access to any other water source to be able to have that narrow scope to work through the normal regulatory process that the DNR has to obtain access to water. And I think that that's incredibly important that we address this session. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Schultz, for presenting your bill. So with that, the bill as amended is laid over. Representative Jacob, House File 1249. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman, committee members, for hearing our House File 1249 today, the lands bill. So first of all, I'll move that 1249 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Representative Jacob, I see you also have a DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you would like. Members, all those in favor of moving the author's amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Your bill is amended and in the shape that you would like. Representative, if you would like to proceed with testimony, go ahead.
Yeah, super, thank you. I do have Lori Klein here from the DNR to kind of explain the bill, and then I will also have Mike and Jeanette Marathier to testify to the 58-acre contribution to the Carley State Park. So we'll start with Lori.
Very good. Lori, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Lori Klein, attorney for the DNR Division of Lands and Minerals. Thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony about the 2025 lands bill today. And thank you, Representative Jacob, for introducing the bill. Each year, the DNR proposes a land bill. The lands bill may include amendments to state statutes that affect administration of state land or DNR's land transactions. It may include changes to state park or state forest boundaries, authorization to sell certain lands. And the lands bill is also typically amended to include tax forfeited land sales proposed by counties. This year, the lands bill has seven sections. One is DNR's proposed state park boundary change, and five sections are tax forfeited land sales proposed by certain counties. Section one is DNR's proposed addition to Carley State Park of approximately 58 acres. This is to facilitate a possible future acquisition of the land. The landowners have expressed a desire to include the donation of this property in their will contingent upon legislative approval, and the landowners are in the audience today. Sections 2 and 3 authorize Aiken County to sell two parcels of tax-forfeited land by private sale. Section 4 authorizes Itasca County to sell one parcel of tax-forfeited land by private sale. Section 5 authorizes Sibley County to sell one parcel of tax-forfeited land bordering public water by private sale. And Section 6 authorizes St. Louis County to sell two parcels of tax-forfeited land by private sale. The DNR has reviewed Sections 2 through 6, which were proposed by the certain counties, and DNR has no concerns about those provisions. This concludes my comments. Thank you for your time today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
If you have other testifiers, I think maybe we could get those folks up to the desk.
Sure. Mike and Jeanette, either one of you want to come and speak to the bill? This is just a really good example of willing participation in our community to expand a real gem, the Carley State Park, and their contribution would border the Carley State Park. So go ahead.
It's real simple. Just whoever's going to speak, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead.
I'm Mike Marath, and semi-happy to speak to you here today. We weren't prepared to say anything, but I did. We met with the Senate, or we watched the Senate deal with the same issue a week or so ago, and I comprised a letter to a representative then explaining why we want to go through this process. It's longer than you want to hear, but I'll read an excerpt from it. Shortly after we acquired our property, a new landowner took over the parcel downstream from us. He clear-cut the woods, he put the tiller to the ground, he planted corn on the steep hills, never ever meant for such activity. After a few years of mismanagement, the farming failed, and the owner then sold the property to an individual who thankfully has respect for the land. Unfortunately, our children are not in professions that will require them to, they're in professions that require them to live in a bigger city, which renders it impractical for them to take over our farm. So therefore, upon our death, our property becomes a risk. The next owner could easily be an individual similar to the person who previously purchased the land downstream. And if not them, there will be future owners who may have the desire to rape the land. This is why it is important to us to gift our property after our deaths to Carley State Park. In addition to preserving the valley, I would love to think my hard work will be appreciated by park visitors for a long into the future. And I don't think I'll bother you with the rest of that. The other important thing from a management position is wildlife corridors are very important. And our property sits between the Whitewater State Park and Carley State Park and provides extra corridor for the wildlife to use. Again, in the Senate, they were talking about mushrooms and everything else gathering. This is another opportunity for the public to take what our property offers. It is a trout stream in a beautiful valley, something that should be appreciated by many.
I'll just quickly point out that this is quite a generous contribution to this region and to this area, and make sure that that's noted today. And if you would also like to introduce yourself, I apologize, I don't have your name in front of me.
I'm Jeanette Morath. This is my spouse. We jointly own the property subject of this. One thing to point out, the total that we own is 58 acres, more or less. And in order for it's our understanding, in order for the DNR to be able to accept a land donation, they first had to establish this boundary, which encompasses our whole property. Now, likely the donation will not be 58 acres. Our residents will be exempted from that, but the DNR is very well aware of this. And if there is zoning in place in our township that would restrict that any, it will depend on what is in effect at the time of our deaths, because that's when this donation would come to fruition. So I just wanted to make that distinction. It's not the whole 58 acres. And depending on the economy of the world, you know, it may be restricted further. But it is our intention to do this. Why? Because we've worked very hard and we've done well. And for the reasons he has already put forth, it's just something that we'd like to do to give back. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony today. And I'll just open it up to anyone else in the audience that may want to testify to the lands bill. All right. Thank you. I really, generous to consider doing something like this. Members, questions? Chair Fisher.
Just want to have a roll call on going out to Ways and Means.
A roll call has been requested. Representative Gottfried.
Yeah, I want to first thank your testifiers today. I think your gift is a donation is incredibly generous, and I understand the reasoning behind it, and I thank you for that. I know some of my colleagues feel concern about other aspects of the bill, some of the sales. which is why I think we're calling for a roll call, if that's my understanding. But I want to iterate to you two that I appreciate your testimony, I appreciate your donation, and I do hope we can at least get that part at some point through. Thank you.
Representative Godfrey, is there anything specifically that you could point to for the benefit of the members and for the public that is objectionable in the bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair, and apologies for breaking decorum beforehand. Still starting a little shaky with decorum stuff for not thanking you beforehand. But specifically, Section 4, the private sale of tax-forfeited land in Itasca County, I believe this is the one that is... what's the sale for? Hold on, I'm going to have to look up the informational sheet here. Oh, it's specifically for one of the ATV clubs that I think some of our caucus members have issue with. But I can let others speak to that if they would like. Thank you, Chair.
Members, any additional questions or comments? Chair Fisher.
Just saying I'd prefer to have it laid over and part of the overall bill that we have come out.
Chair Fisher, maybe there's additional comments if you might have into what the problem might be with the bill, if it's beyond what we just heard from Representative Godfrey.
Just this is our preference at this point in time.
Could I ask Chair Fisher, will this go into an omnibus bill?
I could see most of these provisions going into an omnibus bill.
Okay, members. Any other comments or questions on the bill? Representative Jacob, if you would like to close and maybe renew your motion.
Yeah, I'll just say first of all, it's a good bill. It does have bipartisan support. I had more signers onto the bill today from Democrat side. Thank you again to Mike and Jeanette here for the contribution of the land, and I just encourage support, and I'll renew my motion that House File 1249 as amended be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
I would just add to that, I believe you wanted it as amended, re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
Yes, as amended.
All right, thank you, and we'll take the roll.
Chair Heinzman?
Chair votes yes.
Chair Fisher?
Fisher, no.
Vice Chair Burkle?
Yes.
Vice Chair Purcell?
No.
Representative Falconer?
No.
Representative Finke?
No.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Representative Gottfried?
As written, no.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Jacob?
Yes.
Representative Jordan?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Schultz?
Yes.
Representative Warwas?
Yes.
Members, it is seven yeses and seven noes, so the bill is not moving out of the committee. That completes our agenda for the day, members, and we are adjourned.